morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. Dwight Brooks is our guest today. He is the new chair of the Department of Journalism. He comes to us from Jackson State University, where for 2 years he was in charge of the Department of Mass Communication. Am I correct in that?
That is correct.
Yes. And also, prior to that, you worked at the University of Georgia as a professor of mass communication. It specializes in race and gender issues in the media and diversity, and we're happy to have him both on campus and on the show. Thanks for being here, Dwight.
Thank you, Jenna. I'm just delighted to, one, be a part of this great institution, perhaps an even greater College of Mass Communication. And I will say, as I've been telling everybody who will listen, I have, in 6 weeks, have become an avid listener to WMOT. It's just, well, I'm a jazz lover, so what? It's a match made in heaven.
I'm glad to hear that. When you come not only with a wealth of academic experience, but you also come with a wealth of professional experience. Tell me a little bit about how a department of mass, or a college of mass communication, I should say, as it is here, it tries to balance, or how you try to balance, how you think professors under your purview should try to balance that practical real-world experience and the academic analysis or academic perspective of the profession.
It's a great question, and I think the key word is balance. And I'll be very honest, in my opinion, in my years in the academy, we haven't done a very good job of balancing that. One of the reasons when I left Indiana University and went to University of Georgia was because I thought that the college there, the Grady College of Journalism, really had a strong commitment to the professional side in both training students and allowing faculty to study and examine and explore professional type activities. At Indiana, it was just the opposite. Now, again, a lot of this depends on how the where the university is housed and its commitment. At Indiana, I was in a department of telecommunications, and there was also a school of journalism. But in that department, I just didn't find the type of support or interest in the goings-on of the industry. In fact, I was chastised for doing NatP fellowships, different things that I thought would not only strengthen my understanding of the industry, but would allow me to bring some of that understanding, or a lot of it, back into the classroom. So I'll be very honest. I really think that many universities and many departments or schools, whatever they're called at that institution, really haven't done a good job of balancing the serious study of media with the training and development of media professionals, whether it's by students or by individuals who come into their program. I think there's a solid balance here, but there's still a tension that exists. What you often have are people who are one or the other, right? The industry folk, or who have either worked in the industry or are still working, and then you have the academics, who many of which have been trained in the academy, and that's sort of the tunnel vision that many of them have.
And is there any friction there, or is there mutual respect?
There's lots of friction there. This may sound a bit self-serving, but I've always tried in my career to be one who balances those, but two, who tries to get those two camps, if you will, to talk to each other. It's often hard, but there are frictions. We'll be very honest again and say that I've already sensed some of the friction right here among individuals in particular industries versus the so-called academics. So I suspect it'll be a problem that we always will have in the academy. But I think that the key is balance. And the key I always try to tell faculty, who often lose sight of the importance of professional training, professional development, particularly as it applies to students, it's very simple. Students first. And most of our students come to us, especially at the undergraduate level, with a desire to work in some part or aspect of the industry. And it is our job to train them and develop them to work in an industry that, as you know, is changing so dramatically that it even becomes more incumbent upon us to keep as professors and faculty to keep abreast of what's going on so that we can bring, whether it's developments or trends, whatever it is, into the classroom.
I've seen deficiencies on both ends.
Oh, yes.
When I was working in radio in the earlier part of my career, we would have interns come in from the college with their heads full of Marshall McLuhan, but they didn't know how to use the equipment.
Yeah.
Then on the other end, in more recent years, I have seen television reporters, especially at the local and national level, who know what makes pretty pictures, but I can't help but think that if they knew a little more theory, not necessarily that they would communicate the theory to the audience, but they would use
would
the
help.
Theory internally
sure. Sure.
to help them put better packages together.
I think you've said it exactly. I think if there is one development that may begin to or at least contribute to changing that is that I'm noticing more and more programs are establishing usually at the graduate level, master's programs for mid-career professionals. I know Georgia just started one where they're going to focus on audience research. And I think that will help, particularly from the industry side, folks to have a greater appreciation, not only of the practice of audience ratings, but some of the theory, if you will, behind audience ratings. And I've noticed another university, when I just returned from a conference, is also starting, and I've seen some others, doing creating programs designed for, again, mid-career or even late-career professionals. And I think that'll help.
Okay.
I spend a lot of time with particularly people in the cable industry. And I know there's this perception among a lot of particularly high-level managers in cable as well as in radio and I suspect in television is that, you know, and this has been ever since I was in college, the perception is that we are mainly just sort of teaching theory that has no real application to the real world. And I remember getting into a lot of very, you know, serious discussions trying to dispute that. So there's the perception on their end that, we're just, you know, teaching a lot of stuff that has no real viability to their industry or what is often called the real world.
Well, when you talk about especially diversity and race and gender, you're talking about something that has a direct impact on the real world because the media and the gatekeepers thereof constitute the prisms through which we view what is happening, through which we view society, and through which we view ourselves. And you and I were talking off air a few days ago about how the Radio and Television News Directors Association regularly does these surveys about diversity in the newsroom, how many African Americans, how many women, how many people of color, and so on. But it isn't just about numbers. I mean, we come a long way from the days when, you know, he's the black guy on the staff, send him to the riot, you know, you know, ABC, you know, the fall of Saigon. Well, send Ken Kashiwahara, he's the Asian guy, you know, or sign all the women to do sob stories because they can't do anything any more serious. Yeah. But it's not just about numbers, is it? You can't just plant X number of blacks and X number of women in a newsroom and say, well, we've covered our keysters.
And I think we're learning it. I'll be very honest again. I see the industry actually doing a better job of understanding that the numbers are meaningless in many cases. I'm not sure if the Academy has taken the same approach. There's pressure to diversify within the academic community, and a lot of institutions are really playing the numbers game, or at least maybe believing that that's all it is numbers. But that's another topic that we can get into later. But I think you're exactly right in terms of, and I think as difficult as they are, issues of race and diversity and gender diversity, access to the media by people who've traditionally been shut out, whether it's through employment, through ownership, or just workplace, I think that's one of those issues that has allowed members of the academic community to really dialogue with members of various media industries.
To the extent that we're getting better, it has been made manifestly clear by the election of the first African-American president that we ain't there yet.
Oh, no.
You know, post-racial is still a goal, not a reality. What do you make of the various aspects of reactions to President Obama's brief tenure as chief executive that have manifested themselves in ways that have racial dimensions? The birther story, was he born in this country? The Gorilla Glue statement by Zell Miller, the arrest of Skip Gates and the president's reaction to it. All of these things are unique to this particular president, who has tried to present himself, especially during the campaign, as a potential president of all Americans, and yet is very conscious of the fact that he is the first African American president and everything that that entails.
It's very tough to navigate, and I have tremendous respect for President Obama. And I think he's done a tremendous job of addressing those issues. What troubles me, not from the president's perspective, from some of the individuals and that you mentioned, some of those cases, is that we will often try to deny the role of race in what is a very clear to me, racial incident, or an incident that has racial implications. I make the argument that you can, if you have people involved, there's probably a racial element, because we all have races. And one of the expressions that I just disdain is playing the race card. I think if we're really willing to grapple with the tricky issues of race, and I'd say the same for gender, we have to understand the role that race and gender play in incidents, and not be so quick to dismiss it as race neutral or has nothing to do with race. And so when the birthers are criticized, which to me is a very, I think once you peel away some of those layers, it is about race. There are people who do not accept, in my estimation, the legitimacy of President Obama, in part because he's black. And one of the ways that you can get at that, and perhaps intentionally by not appearing to want to deal with the racial implications of it, is to come up with all of these crazy birthers and socialists and all that. So,
is this a way of people expressing what their revulsion, for lack of a better word, without having that obvious in your face inward impact that something that is blatantly racial would obviously do?
That's exactly what I think is going on. And I think that's, in many cases, unconscious. I don't know if this is a strategy they sit down, okay, now we don't like this guy because he's black, so let's figure out, you know. I just think there is this almost, in some cases, subconscious disdain or resistance to having an African-American president. And I think he's received excessive scrutiny because of that. And I think all of those incidents and others that we could go on, the birthers movement, just the notion of him being called a socialist, are really manifestations of our still to this day inability to deal with issues of racial difference.
When you try to teach students to think critically about race and gender, is it a novel concept to them that race and gender are social constructions, as opposed to something that they feel is organic, one-dimensional, everybody well-defined? Everybody knows what that means. Do you have to do a little deconstructing before you can reconstruct?
It is a tough, I mean, it's perhaps the most difficult issue that I've found in teaching, and I've taught race and gender issues for 20 odd years. And the other thing that makes it difficult is that you have to start there. You know, students will come into a class, look, you know, really with a interest in looking at these issues. But to begin at such a, what may be an abstract level, say, okay, I know what you think race is, but it ain't, you know. But until they can understand not just race as a social constructed category, but what do you mean by a socially constructed category? But it is very difficult. Once they get it, and I'll just to deviate a little bit, students get it often when we talk about gender. And now this is in part a manifestation of the fact that a vast majority of students in our program, and this is at a lot of universities, are female. But once they're able to connect it to their own situation, or whether as a woman I've been discriminated against, and it's not because of my physical appearance, it's because of other cultural and historical reasons, then it begins to sink in, and then they can apply that to race. But it is very, very difficult, and I've tried so many different, and I argue that you need a multi-perspective approach. You need to try different strategies of pedagogy in getting that lesson. But there's no way that we can appropriately understand race and gender and media until we understand that those are just that, socially constructed categories of difference.
What do you do with them in the classroom? Do you get them to analyze advertisements? Do you get them to parse news stories? What vehicles do you use to get them to explore this on a deeper level?
My approach is to use a lot of visual, because we live in a very visual culture. Many college students are very, very visual oriented. So my approach and the goal is to get them more media literate around issues of race and gender, is to move through different media and give them examples, have them deconstruct. There are now, and there weren't when I first started teaching, lots of good documentaries, educational videos that help them do that. Videos on Disney, videos on masculinity, videos on how gays and lesbians are represented in mass media, videos on hate on the internet. So if they can get a sense of how other scholars and other media have critiqued these images, they can, I think, more effectively begin to interrogate those images on their own. So I approach it that you know, there are, you know, if you really understand that race and gender are socially constructed categories of difference, you then have to figure out, well, where do they get socially constructed? And one of the major vehicles in that are media, stories. And so we look at news, entertainment, TV, all of the different, you know, media industries, radio, TV, film. And, you know, now there are, you know, you can look at films that begin to critique that, like Crash and some of the work that Spike Lee does. So there's lots of stuff out there that you can bring into the classroom that will engage students and get them thinking. That's not right.
Spike Lee was recently asked on, I believe it was the 25th anniversary of Do the Right Thing's release as a movie. He says, It hacks him off that people are still asking him why Mookie threw the trash can through the window. Does that surprise you?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, it's if you really think about, you know, how far we've come when it comes to understanding race, and particularly how it plays out in media, if you really think about it, as I often do, you can get very depressed. And when you move from such ecstasy from we've elected an African-American president, you know, we've had women in occupying very prominent places in business and in politics, you can think that we've accomplished more than we have around these issues. We've got such a long way to go. It is, and that's why I think it's important to that's why I think the classroom is an important forum for that, because we've got a lot of work to do.
What about gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender issues? The stage that the media are at now in grappling with what is and is not offensively stereotypical, it sort of reminds me of the stage that people were at when Amos and Andy was getting run on television and the NAACP was against that. Not because it's not funny to have a dumb character and a shrewish character and so forth and so on, but if that's all you're seeing of African Americans on television, contextually, that's all you're going to think they are, is either stupid or a con man or a shrew or servile or whatever. Is there a parallel there with where we are in grappling with gay images now?
In fact, some have made the argument much more articulately than I could do. That you see these parallels, and some of the same arguments are used against gays and lesbians teaching or marrying that we use to keep black people from marrying outside their race, and it's amazing how the same arguments get
recycled.
And so I think that's it's important to note, and I think you know, when I challenge students, you know, because it is no longer socially acceptable to say the N-word or to say I don't like black people, I don't know if we're there yet in terms of gays and lesbians. I know we're not. And so if someone says something offensive thinking it's okay, even if it's in a small circle of friends, when you point out, wait a minute, this is the same thing that they were saying about whatever group fill in the blank 20 years ago, that helps, I think, particularly students, understand and grapple with. I think there's another interesting, and I hadn't really thought through this, but one of the, I think, unique aspects, or where we are when we talk about gays, lesbians, transgendered individuals, it's, I think, one of the things that complicates our discussions is that, while I would argue that it is a socially constructed category of difference, I don't know if our science has given us enough to understand whether or not it is something that we learn, we choose. The evidence is both ways. We now know from the work of genetic scientists that race, you know, isn't about our biology or about skin color, or, you know, there isn't any scientific nature. But until this issue is it learned or nature, you know, that whole argument, and I don't know if it'll be settled, but I think that complicates the matter more, because there are many gays and lesbians who say, I was born this way. There are others who say, I learned this. And if you've learned it or if you've been taught it, I think that gives some people who would be anti-gay the argument to say, well, you can just change, right?
Yeah.
Don't choose that lifestyle.
Are people reluctant to bring science into the discussion because when science was brought into the discussion of race, some racist took the eugenics ball and ran with it?
Yeah. But I think, you know, I think my faith in science as a scientist, not necessarily a social scientist, my faith says that in time, you know, we can rely on, or we, you know, that science has more to contribute. And yes, it'll be misused. But I think, and it's probably the one of the strategies that works most effectively in teaching students that race is a socially constructed category, is just a short video that I show. And actually, it's from a news department out in California, K-Ron, who did a series on race. It was called About Race, and they looked at race in the workplace, race in the schools. And they began by answering that basic question, well, what do we mean by race? And to do that, they brought in these geneticists, Cal Berkeley, famous people. And, you know, for students, that helped. You know, hearing it from me, you know, they expect me as a African-American professor to say that. But when you see these ladies and gentlemen in white jackets and they explain exactly what, that helps a lot. So I still have a certain faith in science. And the other thing in that short clip that they show, they actually address the bell curve, you know, with the attempt to link, you know, intelligence to race and those types of things. And so I don't want to give up on science and you know, hard science especially, but I know that like almost anything, the evidence in the wrong hands can be manipulated, can be used. And so, you know, it's just something that those of us who preach anti-racism, anti-sexism really have to guard against, especially those in the academy, where we really have to make sure that we are, you know, keep abreast of what's going on. It's tough to do, but, you know, that's our obligation.
I've attended class as an older student with students who are 20, 30 years my junior, and when the subject of racism and sexism have come up, they seem to be of the view that it's easy for them to be appalled by the prejudice of prior generations, but some of them seem to believe that their generation has got it licked.
They got it, yeah.
That their generation does not have any of these qualities, either obvious or latent, and it does not seem to occur to them that 50 or 100 years from now, the people who their descendants is what I'm trying to say,
sure,
could look back at them and say, "My God, what a racist, sexist, homophobic generation that was."
No, that I hear that a lot in the classroom. That's my granddad. That's my father or mother, whatever. Rarely are they willing to accept that it's going on in their life. In fact, I've dealt with that with my own daughter. She's now 26, and in high school, my wife and I would try to instill upon her the importance of race and these issues, and she would take the opinion, oh, you guys are, this is not my generation. And for her, yes, she did interact with people from a multitude of races. So I think there is this sense among, I guess, whatever they're called today, Generation Yers or Xers, that they've got it figured out. I think the reality that I see, the empirical, you know, I still see separate cafeterias or students eating and, you know, living very separate worlds. I still see it. I think there's probably a greater sense of acceptance. But, you know, really where we're trying to go is not just a sense of acceptance. It's a real understanding of people who are different and willing to embrace them and accept them as friends, boyfriends, girlfriends. And, you know, again, I'd say society has a long way to go. And I don't know of any sector of our society that can claim that they've made more advances, you know, that they figured it out, or, you know, any generation.
In fact, if you think that your generation is one up on all the other generations, is that not, in essence, ageist?
Yeah, well, no doubt. And I think these are the types of things that when you're dealing with race in the classroom, you have to point out these subtle contradictions. You have to link, you know, these such as you said, to link it to ageism. Because what ultimately I think what we're trying to do is understand how all of these isms are rooted in power relationships. They're rooted in historical relationships that get passed on sometimes unconsciously by our parents. You know, don't tell me you lived in a racist household and that you're come out clean. It doesn't work that way. You know, so it's one of the many challenges of one education. One of the reasons why I enjoy teaching issues of race and diversity. It's very, very difficult. It's, you know, challenging. There are those students who'll say, well, if you didn't talk about it so much, it'd be less of a problem, as a, you know, sort of stick your head in the sand mentality. I mean, it's amazing that the arguments you get over, you know, dealing with these issues over the, I could sit here all night and give you know, some of these anecdotes that students have said. But at least I sense, and I think this is one thing that I would give credit to the students that I've worked with over the last 5 or so years, I think there's a greater willingness to accept and really try to grapple with these issues. Where I think when I was in school and even in graduate school, you know, there were those who could say, you know, hey, this is where I am and I don't like them and that's it. And I think society probably accepted that attitude more 30 years ago. But at least I think that
the students are making a good faith effort.
I think so. I think so. Yes. And that's an important start.
It has been a criticism of the news media since time immemorial that they're lousy at criticizing themselves, and they get really, really defensive when they get critiqued. And it seems to be as true about race and gender issues as anything else.
Sure.
There are men at the network level who get defensive about calling Hillary Clinton Mrs. Clinton instead of Senator Clinton or Secretary of State Clinton, and then they wonder why. Yeah. Would you call Senator Spector Mr. Spector? No, you would call him Senator. Why is this so hard for journalists to get over?
I just think that's the sort of almost subconscious, those canons of journalism kicking in. I think an analogous situation is with President Obama. I mean, almost to this day, I still hear it, not as much, but several months after he was elected, and I still hear it, people referring to him as Obama. Or Mr. Obama, or not even Mr., but Barack Obama, or Barack. I tell black people, I said, I don't think we're entitled to a first name basis. We don't know him. He is the president.
Right.
And I know that, I'm forgetting his name now, one of the commentators on CNN has been quite vocal in criticizing. When he sits on these panels and things, he will make it very clear. If someone says Obama, he corrects them. He's the president. And I think it's again, it's not intentionally trying to diss or disrespect, but I think it just shows you how deeply ingrained our language is when it comes to issues of race and gender. And that's why, again, it all goes back to a socially constructed category. Well, how does it get socially constructed? Through media, through our language. Mm-hmm. And you know, some of it is so unconscious. When I point out things to people, oh, okay, I get that. I think an example of the importance of language is I don't know if I mentioned this to you off air, but it's one that I try not to let any discussion of race, gender, diversity that I'm in, I try not to ever miss this point. So I want to say it because it's my standard talking point.
Okay.
The term people of color, which is an understandable term, it's a well-intentioned term, trying to capture the experience or trying to at least come up with a label for underrepresented groups, for what would be minority groups. But you can very quickly say, well, in some cases, and certainly in the near future, they won't be minorities. So we've used this term, people of color, as a well-intentioned, polite way of referring to African-Americans, Hispanics, Asians. And the other part of understanding diversity is to understand what some would call the flip side of racism, the privilege that certain individuals get by nature of being white. And so whiteness studies, or at least a certain sector of whiteness studies, teaches us, or at least tells me, that a term like people of color, only works to reinforce the notion that white is not a color and white people are not a race.
And that people, quote unquote, of color are the other. It's reinforcing
right.
the other,
right.
and that the white cultural template is the one against everything else has to be
exactly.
measured. That's your baseline mammogram, exactly. as the doctors would say.
And so it's a tough critique because it is a well-intentioned term, and it is to some extent accurate. But as you've just said better than I, there are implications to that term, particularly if we really want to understand race as this socially constructed category of difference that changes over time.
We could go on much longer, but we're out of time.
I understand that. Thank you so much. I enjoyed the talk, Jenna.
I enjoyed it a lot. Please come back.
Oh,
and
I will extend the invitation. I'll be here with you know, bated breath, as they say.
Dwight Brooks is the new chair of the Department of Journalism in the College of Mass Communication at MTSU. I'm Jenna Logue. This is MTSU on the Record. Please join us again next Sunday at this same time. Don't forget, you can catch the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes.